I came down early this morning just to spend some time sitting before giving the talk, and could just feel this increased movement in this area, and so it's just been with that. A memory came to when I was a young boy, around five, and so I grew up in a family where my next sister was 8 years older than me, and my oldest sister and brother, they were 13 and 14 when I was born. So I was not an afterthought, but so I was a lot younger than my siblings, and I have this very clear memory of sitting around the dining table, and what to me looked like these big adults talking, and as this little person found it hard to just even keep up with the conversations and what they're talking about, all these adult conversations, and even hard to find my voice in that environment. And that's what the beating's about, is learning to find one's voice, working with the conditions, just the conditions that we grow up with, and we all work with conditions. And just as I was reflecting on that, and just bringing a degree of just allowing it to be there, not trying to make it go away or change it, and just seeing it for what it was. The my phone rang, and so fortunately there were only about two or three people in here. Back at work, I've got somebody that really wants an answer from me, and so I now have remembered to put it onto airplane mode, and so that won't happen. But it was a stark sort of transition out of that deep sort of reflection and kindness that I was feeling towards myself. And it just reminded me of Ajahn Chah. He would say, he would ask people, "Where do you go? Where do you go?" And so he'd like to question people like this. And there's this lovely story called Still Flowing Water from Ajahn Amaro's book, Small Boat, Great Mountain. So Ajahn Chah is a Thai master in the northeast of Thailand. He's died now, but he's a very wonderful teacher. So he says that Ajahn Chah would put the same question, "Where do you go?" And as they got used to this question, he would switch questions. Throughout his teaching career, he posed a number of different ones. And the very last questions he came up with before his health deteriorated were in the form of a little series. "Have you ever seen still water?" he would ask, and the people around him would say, "Yes, yes, of course, we've seen still water before." And at the same time, they were probably saying inwardly, "That's a pretty strange question, you know. For Ajahn Chah, he's getting a bit old, maybe he's losing his mind." But outwardly, everyone was very respectful to Ajahn Chah. He was one of Thailand's great meditation masters. And then he would ask, "Well, then, have you ever seen flowing water?" And that also seemed a bit strange to ask. They'd respond, "Yes, we've seen flowing water." And then he said, "So did you ever see still flowing water?" And there's a phrase that he would use, Nam Lai Ning. Have you ever seen Nam Lai Ning? And they would respond, no, we've never seen still flowing water. And he loved to get that, it's said that he loved to get that sort of bewilderment. You know, what are you talking about? And he would explain that the mind's nature is still, and yet it's flowing. It's flowing, yet it is still. And he'd use the word citta for the knowing mind, the mind of awareness. And the citta itself is totally still. It has no movements. It's not related to all that arises and ceases. It is silent and spacious. Mind objects, sights, songs, sounds, smell, taste, touch, thoughts, and emotions flow through it. Problems arise because the clarity of the mind gets entangled with the sense impressions. The untrained heart chases the delightful, runs away from the painful, and as a result finds itself struggling and alienated and miserable. By contemplating our own experience, we can make a clear distinction between the mind that knows, citta, and the sense impressions that flow through it. By refusing to get entangled in any sense impressions, we find refuge in the quality of stillness, silence, spaciousness, which is the mind's own nature. The policy of non-interference allows everything and is undisturbed by nothing. So I think it's just such a wonderful piece of writing. It's really pointing to what we're doing here. It's really pointing to our practice of one of returning back, remembering to return back to that still, silent, spacious place in which we know the world, in which we know the rising and falling of all experience, of all phenomena. And so how easily we get pulled into that which is moving. We become identified, we get into struggle with it, resistance with it, and we lose that sense of just being the knowing, being the seeing. And then as our capacity deepens, our ability to just return and to remember, we start to see how we get lost. We see how we get pulled into the delusion, confusion. And we can see that when we get pulled into that which is moving, our thoughts, our ideas, our opinions, our views, in a way how limited they can be, how we cannot see the bigger picture, the clearer picture, the way things really are. How we, as one teacher says, how we can become famously deluded by when we get lost in our experience, in our thoughts, in our ideas, our views. And I'm sure all of you have experienced that here, just how deluded we can become, how we can get locked into a very narrow or small vision around how things are. And I was reflecting on myself, you know, the times when I've become famously deluded on retreat, you know, and I guess that the times when I've become most famously deluded is when I've, you know, been captured by a Vipassana romance, which is where you fall in love with somebody on retreat, and all the thinking and all the attention goes to that object, that person, and you can find yourself believing that they also have fallen in love with you, and sort of when you see their shoes beside yours, you take them. you take that as a sign. Or when they come and sit at your table, it becomes very obvious. You can spend whole retreats doing this. It's my experience. One retreat I went to in Australia, I noticed the mind doing this. And this is after I'd already had a few VRs in the past, so I was familiar with the territory. So I just noticed the mind going to an object, and I thought, okay, I'm not going to follow this. But after some time, I just did. The pull was so strong, and started to believe, there's something going on here. And then one morning, quite not too far into the retreat, thank God, I was walking down the track, and it was in Australia in the bush, and I saw this person's tent, and I saw a man come out of the tent. And obviously her husband or partner. And it was just, it was absolutely shocking. And if you're wondering how come a man was in her tent, I was sort of thinking, well, Australians, they're a little bit... they don't follow the rules. So we can see how deluded we can become. In a way, whole nations become deluded in the ways that we love and hate and get pulled in to the behaviours. Ajahn Mahabua said, "The state of delusion is like a village terrorised by bandits. When the ignorance is dispelled, the bandits no longer hold sway and the whole village is free to go about its business, undisturbed." I really like that. So with awareness, with a clear comprehension, a clear seeing, clear understanding, allows us to see the bigger picture, allows us to come out of that delusion and confusion, and clears the perception, as Sharda was talking about yesterday, so that we can have some deep and deep insight, deep understanding into the truth of things, into the nature of things. And in this, in our practice, the Buddha encouraged us to explore and to investigate three areas in particular. To really start to see more deeply into these areas, which he called characteristics of life, or the features of life, or the marks of life. This is just life, just the characteristics of life, and to really look into and investigate. And so these three characteristics are anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca, change, impermanence. Dukkha, which is unsatisfactoriness or suffering. And anatta, this notion of not self. So I just want to briefly touch into each one of these areas for us to investigate. The Buddha said that it's very important to bring some deep investigation into these areas, because if we do not live by them, if we do not deeply understand them from out of our own experience, if there's not a deep wisdom around the understanding of these, they lead to anguish and pain. And so he encourages us to really, when we develop this capacity to be more still and clear and steady in our practice, to really investigate and see for ourselves, to learn from ourselves. And what we find is that they're both hidden and obvious to us. That they're obvious to us when we actually start to really investigate, when we bring a clarity of seeing to them. But they're hidden when we're just carried away by their habitual energies. of anicca. This is the insight that comes when we see in our meditations that everything is subject to change, that everything is in a state of flux or impermanence, uncertainty, and that suffering comes about when we resist this constant flow, this constant move of all experience, of all phenomena. So easily we fix, we solidify through our concepts, through our ideas about things, through our views, just through not clear seeing, by being distant from experience, there's a fixing, there's a solidifying that goes on. But as we stop and become more still and steady, we start to see that everything is moving, that sights, sounds, the breath, just constantly arising and falling, phenomena coming and going, the sun and the moon. You know, the moon was just so beautiful last night. It was just a wonderful teaching, really. It comes up, it's in the sky for some time, and then it passes. And then the sun comes up. And I love it that the sun and the moon are in these reflections in the morning. They're like our teachers. They're just constantly reminding us about this nature of change. Things are always changing. And we see this in our bodies. We see the breath coming and going. We see sounds coming and going. We see the emotions coming and going. Maybe not so quickly. You know, the emotions seem to hang around for some time. But if we get out of the way of them, we can see that they arise up in us for some time, and then they pass when they're ready, not when we want them to. Although we get into battle with them and think that we don't want these ones, and we struggle with them, and we see that when we do that, we become overwhelmed. It's our struggle with them that overwhelms us, not the emotions themselves. The emotions are just emotions. It's when we judge them or label them as good or bad or right or wrong, and that I don't want them, that we become overwhelmed. We become lost in them. And what we find is that, you know, intellectually we can understand this, but when we actually really investigate this, when we really see the coming and going, what it seems to do is it starts to decondition the habitual ways we cling on to what is moving, the way we resist the movement. It starts to decondition so that allows us to rest back in just the knowing of that which is moving, that which is coming and going, thoughts, emotions, sensations, whatever. It's just this, what is called in Sanskrit, lila, just this play of life. Just this play of life parading before us. And there's just the arising and falling and the knowing of that. The arising and falling and the knowing of that. Consciousness knowing, the movement of life. And what we find is that so easily we react we resist that which is moving, that which has its nature to move. You know, for example, if you find that you're thinking, then can be some idea or some desire to want the thinking to stop. And so we start to get tense and we want it to stop. You know, we have this idea that it should stop and then I can be aware. And then we can start to develop some judgment. You know, judgment about ourselves and struggle and resistance, and all this can be going on. And then we remember. Then we just see what we're doing. We see that the attitude of mind is one of aversion, not wanting. And we rest back in just the knowing of the thinking. And we see that the thinking in itself, when we can just notice the arising and passing of thought, we just see it as just the arising and passing of thought. But it's our reaction to it which overwhelms us. It's all the judgments and the views and the ideas that follow that overwhelm us. All conditioned things arise and pass. Seeing this deeply brings the greatest peace. All conditioned things arise and pass. Seeing this deeply brings the greatest peace. When we're really able to see that, it allows us to rest back in the knowing of this, which is the greatest peace. We're no longer caught or captured by that which moves. And the Buddha said, don't believe me. Explore for yourself, investigate, use this practice, use all the effort that you've put in over the last, can you believe it, 7 days that we've been here. And the momentum that you've built into your practice, really start to use this to investigate, to bring understanding to this yourself, to this characteristic. The second characteristic around dukkha, and the word suffering is often used in Buddhism, but it's many of us have a bit of a reaction to the word suffering. So, but dukkha really means that which is not easy to bear with, that which is not perfect, that which is not satisfying in some way. It's unsatisfying in some way. And the Buddha said about dukkha, he said, birth is painful, aging is painful, sickness is painful, death is painful, encountering what is not dear is painful, separation from what is dear is painful, not getting what one wants is painful. So he's just pointing to the characteristic of life. This is just the way it is. And we get reminders of this all the time. You know, we get challenged by this. We find that the body gets sick, and that can be really challenging for us. It can feel very uncomfortable, very painful. The aging body can be not that easy to live in. You know, there's more aches and pains, and you don't get such good sleeps maybe. And you start to notice that as one gets older. And I see my mother, who's turning 90 in just a few weeks, and it's just a lot of pain, and you're starting to bend over, and she's having to walk really still. Aging is not that easy. In the new year, we visited my friends Sue and Hugh and their children, and Gabriel, one of their children, he's about 13, and we were play fighting, and I got what I thought was the last shot in with him, and I was quite happy with that. And anyway, just before I left, he came up behind me and he gave me a dead leg. And if you know what a dead leg is, he just got his fist like this and he just whacked me in there. And it hurt a bit, you know. And usually when you get a dead leg, you know, they hurt for a few hours or at the most, but then you get over it. Well, this dead leg, it just carried on. I found it really hard to walk that day. And I went home, and it was just getting worse and worse. I thought, what is going on? I found I couldn't walk, and then it developed, all this blood started to show all around the knee. It's this red, and so it was sort of turned into a hematoma. But just from a simple dead leg, you know, just a Charlie. So I was a bit embarrassed by this. You know, I went to walk and I was hobbling into walk, and people were saying, "What happened to you?" I said, "Oh, what And then I had to go to the doctor. After about 4 days, I was really resistant. I didn't want to go, and I had to go to the doctor. And the doctor said, "What on earth has happened to you?" And I told him, and he just roared with laughter. See, oh, you got a Charlie. gave me this morphine, which is quite strong stuff. Which is really lovely. And the hard thing about this was that it was in the middle of summer, and I'd booked some time out at the beach, and all I could do was sit and look out to the coast with my leg up. Couldn't go for swims, could hardly walk. And then, so, you know, life is unsatisfactory. Painful. Getting what we don't want. It's painful. Losing what is dear to us is painful. My little dog Lily died, I think since the last time. And she's a little fox terrier that we got when my son was very young. Been with us for about 12 years. And she was just one of those dogs that was just one of those special dogs. And she died. She died in my hands. And losing what is dear to one is painful. We feel that loss. And no, she's no longer there to greet me when I come home. Losing what is dear is painful. Got an email from Kittisaro and Tanisara. They're running a course, and Tanisara is the woman that we're playing the chants at night. Kittisaro is her husband, partner. And they sent an email, and on it had an Ajahn Chah quote. It says that if your house is flooded or burnt to the ground, whatever the threat to it, let it concern only the house. If there's a flood, don't let it flood your mind. If there's a fire, don't let it burn your heart. And they're saying that we live in a time when our house, our earth, is burning, is freezing, is flooding. The climate is changing in the world over, and every living being is impacted by certain circumstances to these situations. You know, when we're here, it's very hard to comprehend what's happening on the planet. The forests that are being cut down right at the moment, the elephants that are being slaughtered for their ivory, the mining that's going on to fuel the industry, to fuel the greed and the hatred and the delusion, really, which is in each one of us, you can say. So how can we live in this house that is burning without it burning our heart? I went to a retreat. It was one of the teachers on a retreat at Ōtaki, which is focused around the environment and our response to the environment. It was led by Susan Murphy, who's a Zen Roshi from Australia, wonderful woman, and Arthur from down in Christchurch, and myself. I was the insight brought the insight part to the retreat. It was a wonderful retreat, and in it we went through some exercises where we really started to let in, to recognize the changes that are happening. And I guess for me, the thing that came through that retreat was really getting a sense that the environment, the planet that we've got now, is going to be different for our children. It's not going to be the same. And when I grew up, we can swim in the rivers. And swim in the rivers right through summer. That was the great thing about summer. Now, in our area, you can't swim in the rivers in summer. They have all this poisonous algae, which means that you can't, in the middle of summer when you most want to swim, you can't swim. And this feeling, you know, I really felt into that this year, just the pain of that. And because so easy, it's sort of like, it's crept in over the years, and you just start to take it for granted, I can't swim in the rivers. But then I thought, remember back to childhood, it was never like that. Never like that. And it's because the rivers have been polluted.
You could drink from the rivers here.
You could drink from the rivers here, yeah. Yeah. So it meant really recognizing that. And so easily then what the mind does is it wants to judge and blame other people. It's, you know, those people, they shouldn't be doing that. Those farmers, they shouldn't be putting the farming in the way that they're doing. And we do that, and we react, can so easily react to what's happening. Or otherwise we can get into overwhelm. This feels like too big, too hard to open to. What can I do? And the encouragement and the exercises that we did was to just really let this in. Really just feel it. Open the heart to this. Feel it in the body. And amazing things started to happen in the group. And as a group, we really started to feel it as just this, the emerging of this deep compassion for the planet. And that can have a tremendous and powerful impact in how we can be with the house that's burning. So rather than reacting and getting overwhelmed and in conflict, which just adds to the more greed, hatred and delusion, reactivity. Actually really deeply opening and feeling the dukkha, feeling the pain, and out of that coming a response, the heart's natural response, compassionate response. And that doesn't mean that we just sit there in that compassionate space, but it means that we can access a compassionate response, a wise response, which might mean that we need to be firm and assertive, as we were talking about last night with our minds, yesterday of the mind. But finding, each of us finding our response, which is not out of a response of reactivity, but it's out of a deep response, a deep wise response, a deep compassionate response to this condition. The other thing is that as we really open to, and Stephen Batchelor talks about it as embracing dukkha, really knowing dukkha. This is what the Buddha is asking us to do. So easily we can have this idea, nah, that's bad, I must be doing something wrong. You know, it's and there can be just this wanting to dismiss it or bypass it, you know, come up into some clear open space and bypass this in a way. He's saying that we really need to open to this. And what happens is not only does it allow the heart to respond in a different way, but we also see very clearly the suffering that arises when we resist, when we reject, when we fight with this characteristic of pain, of dukkha. And so the encouragement is to really investigate that, to really see dukkha for what it is. It's just a characteristic of life. It's not good or bad or right or wrong. It's just a characteristic that as a human being we're going to experience. And I like this, through holding lightly with compassion and kindness, we recognize the true nature of conditions and we let go of wanting a condition to be able to deliver what it is not able to. So we stop expecting conditions to deliver what they're not able to deliver. The third, anatta, which is the Buddha pointed out, which is the belief that we have a separate self, this characteristic of not-self. It sometimes is called selflessness, but that doesn't fit for me. Not-self seems to be a better way of seeing this. And the Buddha said this is not only the biggest delusion we have, but it's the biggest attachment we have. So this is the one he really encourages us to investigate and to look into this notion of not-self. And he says this very clearly. He says, this body is not me, mine, or I. To really investigate that. These feelings are not me, mine, or I. These perceptions are not me, mine, or I. These mental formations or concepts or thoughts are not me, mine, or I. This consciousness is not me, mine, or I. And it really encourages us to investigate and to look deeply into that. Not to believe him. And so these teachings are saying that, they're not saying that we don't exist, that there's not a personality, because clearly there is a personality. These personalities that are conditioned from the past. So he's not saying that. But what he's saying is there's a way of examining when the mind says, my back, my anger, my problem. There's a way of examining that to see the truth of it. To see what this minus is, the sense of me-ness. Where is it? Where is it located? What does it look like? And I love the idea of the a mirage. You know, there's this, yes, the mirage in a desert. So there's a desert and you're walking and it's very hot. And people will often see little oases in the distance, you know, palm trees and water and all this sort of thing. And so you think, oh, there it is. There's this oasis. We're going to be saved. And get closer and closer and it just disappears. It's a little bit like that with this me-ness, minus, this I. The more we turn to look at it, the more it disappears. We can't find it. I was determined after hearing these teachings to really explore this. And so I'd just sit and I'd just wait to see the movement. You know, when there is the movement of an eye, you know, oh, I'm meditating now. And just the mind would just turn. Oh, there it is, I. And what it did, it's like, and as some of you have said, is that when you turn the attention to a thought, it just dissolves. So if I do that, if I turn my attention to an eye, I've got such a sore back. Turn the attention to that. It just dissolves. So where does it go?
The back doesn't dissolve.
The back doesn't dissolve. The eye dissolves just in that moment. Back's still there. But that sense of my back, the eye-ness just dissolves, that thought. So who are we then? So this questioning, this investigation really starts to undo the places where we hold on to a sense of self, this sense of me and my and I. And what we find is when there's grasping and wanting, that the I is very strongly in there. I want, I like, I don't like. You know, and it's so repetitive. It can just be going, ah, bad, bad, but I'm the that, I'm the that, I. And it's so constant that we have the sense that it's solid, that it's this. We get the sense of I-ness. This is me. Until we start to turn our attention to it, and we start to see that it starts to break up, and it starts to undo that identification. And we see that it's this I that sort of is like the dog. It pulls us out of ourselves. It pulls us into the world of phenomena, so that we become identified in it. And through seeing it, we rest back. It's just a resting back in the awareness of the knowing. The knowing of the coming and going, the arising and passing. So seeing in this way, it starts to really question. It's disturbing in a way. You know, incredibly disturbing when we've just taken this for granted all these years, and suddenly we start to see this. It starts to break up. These ideas that we can have about ourselves. I'm such an aversive type. Go away. Or I'm no good. Or I'm unlovable. And when we start to investigate into these ways that we view ourselves, well, I've got to do this. Well, I should do this. When we start to see that and investigate this, the I-ness of it starts to break up. Starts to get undone. We just start to see these patterns, these stories, just as patterns and stories. And so easily what happens then, very subtly, is that then the I attaches to awareness. You know, so it's very subtle. You know, the I wants to maintain itself, and it starts to say, "I am aware now." It's so tricky. It wants to maintain the sense that it doesn't want to completely let go. And so we see that just how the eye attaches to awareness. And then we let go of that. We're just seeing that awareness is just arising with the object. There's the sound of the bird and there's the awareness rising together. The breath and awareness, the thought and awareness arising together. That's all that's happening. That's all that this is the arising and the knowing of the arising, moment after moment. The Buddha, when asked if he could summarize his teachings in one phrase, he said, "Sabbe dhamma nalan abhihisavaya." Said, "Nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. Nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine." And he says, Whoever has heard this core phrase has heard all of the teachings of the Buddha. And whoever has practiced this had practiced all the teachings. And whoever received the fruits of practicing had received all the fruits of the teachings. So we investigate this. Encouragement is to investigate deeply, to explore anatta, so that one sees clearly for oneself. And as with all of the characteristics, we in those times when there's a sense of steadiness and stillness and there's some clear comprehension, there's some real opportunity to just turn the mind to exploring, to investigating each one of these characteristics so that we can see for ourselves, so we can deeply understand what the Buddha was pointing to. It's gone a little bit longer than I intended to, so I'll finish there and we'll open it up to questions again. Questions and comments and reflections and even what you might be seeing in your own practice.
Express ourselves without constantly reinforcing. And it's also almost impossible to say anything without basing it in an I.
Yeah. And so we use the word, the language all the time. And so it's not saying that we have to abandon that.
Yeah, but if we're not aware of it, we're not thinking about it, we're constantly reinforcing that idea.
That's right. And so the encouragement is to really investigate, you know, to take the time to really investigate. And when you've seen deeply into that, then we use the language. There's no conflict there. But a sort of a reminder, as you're saying, is that people like Krishnamurti, I don't think they would use words like I. He would say the speaker. Possibly for that reason. Just to keep pointing to that.
We don't want to do that.
We don't want to do
that. It's also a function of our very linear language, where we have to have a subject and an object in English to make sense. I was reading how in Japanese, where we would say, the man sees the dog, in Japanese it's man dog see.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. It's quite hard to get your head around it when you're learning a new language, isn't it? Maori's a bit like that too.
When I was up on the ridge, I think day before yesterday, I was reflecting on state of environment because that's largely my work, and realizing that this whole thing about sustainability, no one really gets. It's very hard for people to understand what it really is, and I was realizing that the only way to understand it and have wise response was in awareness.
And what is it, just to say a little bit more, what did you understand about awareness? Why awareness?
Because that's the only place I could go to get a wise response, to see what was really happening. Mm-hmm. get a response, I'm very happy.
Because you're seeing clearly in that moment, your mind isn't clouded with all the confusion, mm-hmm. right? So you can see more clearly and directly what's needed.
Yeah,
that's right. I mean, that's the key, isn't it?
One of the and I'm not sure. I tried to look it up before I came down. One of the Zen patriarchs said was asked what are the teachings of the Buddha all about. And he said a wise response. And
I said, "Bring it up."
They just don't chase it there, but finding their way.
How did you even get in? But that's what just happened is an expression of compassion, right? See the suffering and want to respond immediately to relieve that suffering. Just it's just natural. It's so much part of us when we're here, you know. We're here and then we can see what's happening and respond. That's actually what you were just talking about.
Well, the interesting thing is if you some of the research shows that when enough people respond from that place, it can make a big difference. And there's been examples of that, you know, with the change in thinking around slavery, for example, in America, when there is enough people where the awareness, the shift in the consciousness around the okayness of slavery shifted, it just changed. And so the encouragement from the work that we are doing is that when people really get what's needed, and they respond with that place of awareness and compassion, something can really make some big difference. So I think it's important work for us to really do.
It can be quite can be easy to drop into despair and I suppose those extremes. So, holding
your awareness of the possibility of peace. Yeah. And sometimes
myself, I think, well, what is the future of the human race? Mm. There is that possibility as well. Mm.
Yeah.
And I think
it's...
Not to drop into total
despair with it. Mm-hmm. So to really open to that and to feel the pain of that. Really allow that in without either reacting, getting reactive or getting overwhelmed. And seeing it's almost like bringing some kindness to the part that gets overwhelmed. It's like when I was reflecting, when I first started, this is the part where the heart was beating, and it's just bringing some kindness to that.
But also being able to celebrate, like you say, changes over the last 70 years in terms of what we would describe as wise parenting and non-violent communication.
It's a lot of good. It's a lot of good.
I was really aware of the wonderful things that happened, that are happening around the world, like with at summer solstice, there was a whole movement creating hubs right around the world called Birth 2012, and incredible linking and activities on that solstice, and you know, for the raising of consciousness, and I think there were millions involved with that, which was, you know, really beautiful. And also the organisation, I think, Pava is it, that has, I think, 30 million belonging in that organisation. It's an internet thing where they bring out the causes, like the last one was the elephants and what's happening with them, and, you know, signing a petition. And it's really wonderful, positive.
Yeah. Some really strong, positive responses, wise responses. And that's what I'm seeing, you know, when you also start to see the responses, there's a lot of wisdom, a lot of the traditional peoples are finding their voice and leading some of these responses too.
It's probably the best thing that's happened in terms of the internet, is that it brings the collective consciousness together. And as Jeremy's saying, you know, as we join together, there's more of a power in that, what can be the action. So 30 million, that's a lot of power. So the more that we collectively come together, some difference is going to happen.
A few days ago, I went for a walk on the way up to the Far Hills hut, because we've had this bit more loose time. I've had a chance to go exploring places I haven't been before. And on the way back, quite close to the hut, I came across this huge tree stump. It's a massive tree and burnt out, and just felt so sad, and just put my hands on it and just said sorry. And felt like, oh, what a waste, this tree's, you know, like maybe someone burnt the farmland. And then last night I was up at Rongall Rock, right up on the ridge, looking down over the valley again, and just feeling a lot of gratitude for the Dharma, and realised that the time in my life I could have been very destructive and could have done terrible things, and actually felt so overwhelmed by my own pain that I wished for the destruction of the earth. That's what I wished for. And just realising that I'm so grateful that I met the Dharma and had a chance to learn the causes for that suffering, and to be free of that degree of hatred, I guess. And realising that who knows why the land was burned, who knows what was in the hearts of the whoever, or why, you know, maybe there's something natural happened, who knows. But just feeling like all those same conditions are burning in lots of people's hearts still, and that's really what needs to be addressed.
Yeah. Thank you.
I was reflecting how everyone in here becomes a teacher for me, and I was like classes, what's new. I found it really useful to not only apply that to stories, but also to apply it to experiences and insights, because what I'm aware of is that my mind tries to conceptualize all the experiences and tries to conceptualize insight, because insight comes from outside the mind. It's not something that the mind has a capacity of. It comes from outside the mind, so it tries to conceptualize it so it can kind of size it down and own it. And then it tries to keep going back to the same experience or the same insight once it's conceptualized and owned. So it tries to fix it in this in this place, try to go back to it, which then kind of hinders the natural process of new insights to arise. So it's kind of this attachment to the experience and to containing it, because new insights are almost like a threat to the identification of the mind. So I've been kind of using this what's new to apply that as well, not in the sense of seeking another experience, but in the sense of actually just releasing that attachment, that the mind, that kind of movement towards holding on to experiences or insights.
Mm-hmm. It's really good what you're seeing and what you're saying, and it might help you get even a little bit closer to the issue if, instead of saying the mind is fixing it, say I'm fixing it. Because that's the I right there. That's the movement of the I to take ownership. And then to create a whole identity around, I've got an insight. And then the specialness, it's all around wanting to be somebody who has insights and be special. And, you know, it's the whole movement of the ownership and the fixation. So what you're describing is actually the way the I comes into being. And as you see that, and that relaxes, then the sense of I relaxes, right? So that's the mind that you're speaking about, the mind that takes ownership. Right? Does that seem to resonate with what you're saying?
Yeah.
Because that's the very movement that we're wanting to understand. What is this I? How does this I come into being? And what happens in the mind? Which is a lot of what you're exploring right now. Yeah. It's really good to see that. So subtle. Even the insight, the wisdom, all of it can just be hijacked. Right? It gets hijacked by the ego mind.
Right. If it's not seen.
Yeah.
I'm always challenged by kind of the borderline concepts between different languages, because two words never exactly match, like between metric and imperial, they are nothing exactly. In German, it's ich means ego, literally translated, and then there's the other concept of selbst, which is a kind of transcendental, universal, more than personal. So in English, the word mind kind of suggests it's mine.
Mind?
Through the
mind suggests
word.
My? Mm. Uh-huh. Already. So mind already suggests the ego. Mm. Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah, so as we were saying, the language, different languages support the view in different ways. I mean, we just happen to have this English language, which I think is not the most sophisticated in terms of this wise view, the wise perception. You know, I think as Adam was saying, some of the language can just recondition again and again the wrong view, the problematic view. So, it's very interesting to start looking at it from a point of view of language.
I'd like to add the issue of value. I'm just connecting to Roger's statement about the tendency to be struck. And I was just thinking, I was struck by what happened before in the room when the Fente came in, how much we were, as you said, we were willing to help and compassionate. And at the same time, a blowfly comes to you. And sort of like, and
it's easy.
Yes, it is. And it's interesting how I identify more than with a pentacle.
Yes.
And how I say no, the blowfly is the other. And it's a dilemma because it depends also which level of awareness we, which context we put to it. I mean, I love that what you probably all know that from Thich Nhat Hanh, the I'm the mayfly, I'm a rapist, I'm the all this, what we don't want to identify with. It's a dilemma, it's hard.
Yes. So that poem has a good title. It's Call Me by My True Names.
Call Me by My True Names. Yeah.
Call Me by My True Names, which I'm all of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very good. Very good. And as you said that, I imagine the compassionate response to the fantail and then wanting to kill the blowfly. It's right there, you know? It's just.
Right.
It's right in the psyche somehow, in the genes, way we're made up. Mm-hmm. That's, I see that more and more from the lower brain. You know, that's the animal reptilian brain. But what we're attempting to do is to use other parts of our brain, so we're not just responding from a reptilian, from the animal. But evolving, hopefully we're evolving, using more of our neocortex.
And every time we think we know something, I think we need to step back and realize we really don't.
Mm. Yeah.
Washing windows this morning, I thought, well, you know, I'm certainly learning transients, hands on windows, birds flying into windows, and then I thought, well, if the windows are too clean, it could hurt the bird. We know nothing. Whenever we think we know something, we just have to remember we're born to die, and so is everything else.
Yeah. Keeping the bigger picture, right? The bigger picture. One of the listening to Jeremy's talk this morning, there was one piece that, and we were discussing this morning too. We have these very wonderful Dharma discussions at breakfast. You know, to really feel so much gratitude for that, to have that opportunity to explore the Dharma together. And one of the things that really got highlighted for me today is just to see again that with these three. Characteristics are called the three characteristics of existence because that's the way it is. It's like there is change, there is suffering, there is this insubstantiality or selfless nature. And it's not like that's something we have to change or get rid of or get, you know, see. It's like the suffering is not something that we can overcome. There is suffering in this world. There is suffering. That's the first dictate of the Buddha. And I can see how easy it is to imagine that there's some way to overcome that suffering. And the more I really consider it and the more I think about it, the Buddha was not talking about that suffering, overcoming that suffering. There is loss. There is grief. There is sorrow. There is, we don't get what we want. We lose the things that we love. We get sick. We age. We die. That is the way it is. That's what you're saying. And so it's a a different orientation in the practice. To open to that truth, to allow that truth, to accept that truth, and then to look at how we're relating to it. Because it's the relationship to it that creates more difficulty for us. If we resist it, if we reject it, if we deny it, if we ignore it, if we suppress it, that creates even more suffering and difficulty for us. So that's what we're looking at. We're constantly looking at our relationship to the way things are. This is the way things are in this worldly plane, in this world that we live in as human beings. There is dukkha. There's no way around it. It's something that Jeremy and I have really been really sinking into, that truth of that this time, in a way that I haven't before. Because there's this tendency, as he was saying, to think somehow something's wrong, or something needs to be fixed, or I'm wrong, I must have done something wrong. I'm experiencing this dukkha, this pain, this sorrow, this sense of grief because I've done something wrong and I need to get better and I need to get more enlightened. I need to
practice harder.
Huh?
Practice harder.
I need to practice harder and then I won't feel this experience. It's not what the Buddha was talking about. That just the proclamation, there is suffering, there is dukkha in this world. Full stop. Let's not make that more difficult. That's what the Buddha was asking us to examine. Look at your relationship to that truth.
That when we really see that, it really informs what our relationship to it is.
Yeah.
When you really go into dukkha, you see the relationship, our relationship to it becomes much more clear. And that then we can let go of.
And then you see that it's going to change. Mm-hmm. It's not going to stay this way all the time. Everything's constantly changing, and it's not so personal. Mm. It's not as personal as we take it to be. So those three characteristics just weave in and out of each other and inform each other. Sorry, was it Wes Nisker? He just says, shit happens. And it's going to change, so don't take it personally.
Get used to it.
The universe is persecuting me.
Exactly. The universe is persecuting me. It's a whole new kind of dropping, the accepting of the way things are. This is the pointing to equanimity, to the ground of equanimity. Not to get caught in the contentious mind, the mind that is in opposition to.
The equanimity phrase, things are the way they are.
How much did Kodak moments contribute to attachment?
Kodak moments.
So maybe that's a good place to stop. I brought along with me, when I've been teaching the retreat the last couple of times, it's...
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.